Our text is our reading from Romans 13. Do this, knowing the time, that it is already the hour for you to awaken from sleep. For now, salvation is nearer than when we believed. The night is almost gone. The day is near. This is our text. I've been thinking about it and have decided that I am rather fond of the night. It is, after all, part of the very fabric of creation itself. There was evening and morning, a day. And so it seems that there's something intrinsically good about both halves of the 24-hour rhythm of dark and night, night and day. And nights are quite essential for some rather extraordinary parts of life. Stargazing, admiring the neighborhood Christmas display, chasing fireflies and marveling at the northern lights just don't work in the daylight. And nights are perfect for campfires. The camaraderie, the conversation, and the deep reflection of a campfire whose life cycle seems to go from leaping, crackling flames to steady, easy warmth and then to gently dancing, dying embers, reflecting the mood and interaction and setting the pace for those who are encircling it. But perhaps best of all, nights are for sleep. After a day jammed full with everything, there is little that can rival the sweet release of sleep. But my reverie and my delight in the wonders of the night is rudely and abruptly interrupted and fundamentally challenged by the apostolic exhortation. Paul is rather insistent, and he's sure that his readers will agree with him. You know what time it is, he writes. It's H hour, time to be raised up from sleep. I hate that time. 5 o'clock a.m. always comes far too soon. Most of the year it comes well before even the faintest hint of a new day. But there is no option. The rhythm of the day makes its demand. The comfort of the bed must be abandoned and the tasks of the day confronted. Paul's point is clear and it resonates. Tempting as it is to linger in a state of checked out, unthinking, languid sleepiness, the night must be left behind. The night is trouble. And Paul's not done with his diatribe against the night. It is the inky darkness of night that provides the ideal cover for the creeping, sneaking, shameful perversions of sinful people. Drunken orgies, promiscuity, sensuality, envy, strife. Paul's list of the sins of the night is hardly exhaustive, and being experts on sin, we could easily add to the litany. The ideal setting for sin is night. The night is trouble. Indeed, as Paul sees it, the night is good for only two things, both of which must be shunned, sleeping and sinning. And of course, the apostle is right. He knows that the night, with its darkness, is a potent metaphor for a world overrun with creatures hiding from God and living in self-consumed isolation. Just as he does with the flesh and the world, Paul makes a word describing a good part of God's good creation, and he takes that word and he sharpens it to use it as a term to capture and focus the horror and the shattering destruction imposed on God's masterwork by the arrogant rebellion of sinful man. We all know that nights are not always blissful hours of quiet rest or pleasant passages of wholesome fellowship with kindred spirits. We too endure the ugly reality of sin. Not only that sin afflicted on us by others reveling in the dark, but also the sin manifest in our own yearning and plotting and doing in the dark. We know the sin of the night only too well. It defines our own lives. The night is a terror of sinful deeds of our own doing. And in the dark night of sin, we long for daylight to come and drive away our own dark shadows of sin. You experience that same desperate desire for the dawn of the day during those nights when sleep eludes you altogether, and minutes drag into hours as you wait for each new number to appear on the clock, or worse yet, when the sleep that does come is a surreal slipping in and out of feverish consciousness, fueled by dark, desperate thoughts, twisting into nightmares, merging into half-waking hallucinations. On nights like that, you cannot wait for the day to come to free you from your sweat-drenched sheets and the torture of the night. It has been night for a long, long, long time. But again, Paul was right. The night is now far spent. It's almost over. The reign of terror is nearing its end. The affliction of sin will soon be done. D-Day is at hand. H hour is waiting at the corner. The dawn is hovering just over the horizon. It will be here before you know it. Even more certain than the dawn of a fresh day that casts its clean, bright light on the dark suffering and the filthy shame of the night, Jesus will soon dawn on this world and reclaim it fully as his own. Whether it happens today or another 2 millennia from today, it will happen. And that holy certainty makes it a present reality that is perpetually just a moment away. C.S. Lewis captured this so well. Our world, he recognized, lives constantly in a suspended reality that is at once a heavy, weary waiting and a tingling, electric anticipation. It's just there, right at the cusp of the dawn, right at the brink of the brilliant new day. Jesus is right there and ready. And at a single word from the Father, he will come in spectacular, streaming glory and grace, and the night will be over forever. You know this. And knowing this, you live this. You see, for you, the hour has already come. Right now, you live awake and jubilant and even giddy in the ebullient confidence you have in the promise. After all, the coming of Jesus is not just a promise. It is your present reality. He is here. He is with you. He is present now, just as he promised, in word and sacrament, and in the lived reality that is his church. And so you live today and tonight in the light. The darkness is done. You sleep, you wake, you serve, you live in Jesus, the one who raises you up from your sleep each day and on the last day. Amen. We come to the hymn.